Yeah, thank you, Ora, for first leading the Women's Beit Midrash in general. I think it's something that's long overdue. We wanted to do it for years, and now that we have it already in the second year, that's a wonderful thing. So thank you, and thank you for inviting me, although not necessarily thank you for inviting me for this topic. Because honestly, this is, I think, it's the first time I've spoken about most of this topic. Parts of it I've addressed in different shiurim, but this is certainly the first time I've collected it all together, which means what you're hearing are first thoughts, and I am open to changing my mind during this shiur or afterwards. So I'd be very curious to hear what people have to say. There's a lot of material here. How much of it we'll get through is a good question. We're down to about an hour and a quarter, so we'll see. But basically, the question that we're asking, in its most broad form, is not so much a women in halacha specific question, although it seems to come up a lot in women in halacha topics, but it's the question of how does halacha go from the simple black and white categories of this is allowed, this is not allowed, right? Mutter, usser, straightforward, to... well, the sense of Judaism is that we wouldn't do this, or, we just don't do that, or the sense is that this is an okay thing to do, whatever it is. How is it that halacha becomes fuzzy? That's the question, from halacha to meta-halacha. And the most recent round of this came up in February when the OU released a paper on female clergy. And the paper promoted advanced women's education, opportunities for women to teach communally, hedged a little bit on Yoad Sod Halacha, came out flat against female synagogue clergy, and gave a few reasons for it. The first part of their analysis was based on relatively straightforward halachic considerations related to smicha, related to serving in a rabbinic position, needing to be a dayan, a judge, the question of sarara, is this considered a position of authority, is that appropriate, not appropriate, but the topics they were dealing with were relatively straightforward in the sense that they were known halachic categories, prohibitions, and so on. The second category was their discussion of precedent. And they said, well, we haven't had female clergy before, even though there have been female scholars. And the argument was, since we haven't had them before, clearly we're not supposed to. And that's its own discussion as to whether, that works. Is that really a halachic thing of what we call lo ra'inu en araya, that we haven't seen it? Is that adequate as a proof or not as adequate as a proof? But the third part is the part that I wanted to talk about here, and that was what they called the halachic ethos. Right? Ethos is a fun word. It sounds like ethics, which automatically makes me feel like, oh, this is a good thing. But what actually are we talking about when we say ethos? So take a look at source number one, please, which is pulled from the paper of the OU panel itself. There is much more in the paper. I recommend reading it. But this is just the direct part that we're going to address. A Welten or Weltanschauung, right, which I translated for you there on the sheet, a worldview. It seems that students of Rav Soloveitchik feel the need to throw Weltanschauung into academic sounding papers. So it's there. A worldview emerges from the totality of the vast sea of halacha and Torah thought. And this collective worldview serves as the basis of our Avodat Hashem. These overriding principles are mined throughout through the examination of Mikra, Halacha, and Precedent. When we look at Mikra, Halacha, and Precedent, we come up with a worldview of what Judaism wants the world to look like. Mikra. While most legal sections of the Torah are comprised of specific commands, right? Mikra is text. So while most legal sections of the Torah are comprised of specific commands, many general injunctions can be found as well. Examples of such directives include Kedoshim Tehiyu, you shall be holy, Shabbaton, the Torah's description of a day of rest as Shabbaton, and Vasita Hayashar Vehatov, you shall do that which is righteous or right and good. The Ramban's commentary to these psukim, as elaborated below, highlights the manner by which these general exhortations significantly shape normative practice. What they're saying here is, there are laws in the Torah, like don't wear woolen linen, and then there are passages in the Torah which convey an ideal, but don't really give specifics. Saying you shall have a Shabbaton, a day of halting, or a day of rest, doesn't really tell me what I'm halting from and how exactly I'm supposed to rest. Saying you shall do that which is righteous and good doesn't define what is righteous and good. They're overall categories. So they're saying that by looking at those categories, we get some sense of what the Torah wants the world to look like, even without specifics and transcending specifics. The next area is halacha, a comprehensive study of the details of specific halachot, reveals fundamental principles which provide guidance for the development of a deeper and more expansive understanding of the details themselves. In other words, in one sense, in the first category, I'm learning Torah's worldview by seeing the overarching categories that it defines, like be good, right? Things like that. And then in the second, they're going the opposite direction, the micro, and saying sometimes a particular halacha will teach me the Torah's worldview. When the Torah tells me to do something specific, for example, the Torah says that if you see somebody's animal by the side of the road is struggling with its burden, you're supposed to help. So that gives me a sense of what kind of human being the Torah wants me to be. So, in one sense, I get from the macro, the overarching, and in another sense, I get from the micro. And then third, I'm jumping to the third section here, precedent. When you have precedent in an area of halacha, they say the Torah worldview is also shaped by precedent, while, as discussed earlier, long-established practice assumes presumptive validity. There are too many syllables. What they're saying is that when you have something that is done for a long period of time, it is assumed that that includes, or that is meant to teach us, the general values of the Torah. So what they're saying in this section, and I invite you again to read the paper in entirety, what they're saying in this section is that there is some sort of overall sense that the Torah is trying to convey, whether via macro principles, whether via specific halachas, or whether just by the precedent, the body of what Jews do, that somehow is supposed to teach me and be implemented by the rabbis in this case, what it is that is supposed to happen in a particular halachic situation. And this is the area that is very gray, because really, you can derive whatever you like, right? The two people can look at the same data and come to different conclusions. How does this work? What exactly is it that we're supposed to do with this category, which I'm calling meta-halacha, as opposed to straight halacha? This is meta-halacha. So I'm going to lay out the problem a little bit further and then jump into the sources. In general in life, actions are not to be separated from their context, right? The rightness or wrongness of an action depends in part on the world in which it takes place. So it's fine to shout, right? But not during a movie, right? Generally speaking. If you're watching it on your own at home, that's fine. That's a different story. It's bad to jaywalk, but it's really bad to jaywalk in front of small children, right? Because they learn the wrong lessons. Or they're learning the right lesson, but it's whatever, you know what I mean. It's good to check your email. It's not good to check your email every 30 seconds. Right? Actions are judged based on their context. In halacha, some matters of context are clear. Ice cream may be kosher, but not right after I ate a hamburger. Right? Speaking to a friend is good, right? But not during Kedusha. Texting your parents that you love them is sweet, but not on Shabbos. You know, things like that. Context determines whether this is a good thing to do or not a good thing to do, and sometimes it is relatively clear. But other matters of context are less clear and require the implementation of this meta-halacha. So, for example, answering amen loudly. Okay, you're in shul, someone's saying Kaddish, and you answer amen loudly. Is that good or bad? Bad. Why?
Because you can't answer louder than the person that.
So you're jumping to the halacha, right? You're jumping to what you know the Shulchan Aruch says, which is that you're not supposed to be louder than the person who is actually saying Kaddish. Let's pretend you didn't know that, or let's say it's not a shul and Kaddish. It's someone, someone sitting here made a bar mitzvah mezonos on pastry, right? Loud amen, good or bad? Fine. So on the one hand, you could say loud amen good because it can inspire people. On the other hand, loud amen bad because it can make people laugh and mock, and you're actually inviting people to make fun of you. holding a weekly poker game with your non-Jewish neighbors in your home. Good or bad?
Bad.
Why? I'm creating good social relations with my neighbors.
You're probably eating and drinking with them, too, and you may end up marrying their son.
Okay. So, potentially blurring social lines. Right? Potentially blurring social lines. Or, within some elements of the Jewish community, you will find that men and women do not look at each other when they're having a conversation. If they need to speak, they won't make eye contact. Right? Good or bad? I'm asking what you think. I'm not asking. I hear a bad. Why is it bad?
Because when you talk to someone, you look at them. And there are many great big rabbis in those communities that will look at you, and it's sometimes their followers that don't look at you.
Okay. So one way you can look at it is that it's protecting piety. In other words, they're going to make sure that they're going to protect proper social relations. The other way to look at it is that it casts halacha in a bad light. It creates a negative impression. It can be a turnoff for people. So what I want to talk about in this area of meta halacha, and what I think they're trying to say in more syllables in source number one, is that there has to be a halachic mechanism for evaluating context and applying it, for deciding how to apply the law and dealing with this gray area. And it's a monster-sized topic. We could be here all day. We're not going to. But what I want to do is take us through three different categories of halacha and how we apply meta halacha, how it is that we deal with things. Some of it will be the women in halacha topic, and some of it's going to be broader than that. So our first category is what I called applying halachic principles. This is the easiest and simplest and most straightforward category, and we're going to start with some examples to explain what we're talking about. Source number two is a Mishnah in Psachim. It's talking about going to work on Tisha B'Av. Right? Tisha B'Av is not one of those days when the Torah prohibits malacha, because Tisha B'Av is after. It's after the Chumash. It's not going to be found in there. It represents biblical concepts, and it was practiced going way, way back. Right? The Jews write to Zechariah in the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash and ask him, shall we continue to fast in the fifth month? Fasting was going on very early on. But the question is, can you go to work? So this Mishnah in source number two says to us, and I'm not going to read it out loud. Some of the sources I will, some of them I will not. But this Mishnah in source number two says it's a matter of minhag. It's a matter of local custom. In a place where people customarily perform halacha on Tisha B'Av, you're allowed to. In the place where they customarily do not perform halacha on Tisha B'Av, you're not allowed to. Everywhere, Talmidei Chachamim, which I translated loosely as Torah scholars, are idle. They don't engage in work. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, you should choose to be a Torah scholar for this purpose. You should say, I'm not going to do work, even if you live in a place where people do go to work. And there's a nice debate on this in the Gemara. What's wrong with what Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel recommends? With the idea of somebody saying, well, I'm going to be a Torah scholar and not do work on Tisha B'Av, even though everybody else here does? Yeah?
That person might think, because they're not doing malacha and everyone else is up there, better than everyone else.
What they might think about themselves, okay, but let's say they're not deluded. They know exactly who they are. There's another concern, right, which is what everybody else is going to think. Who is he? I know him. He doesn't open up a book all year long. Suddenly on Tisha B'Av, he's a Talmid Chacham. Why is he not going to work? This is a concern for what's called in Aramaic yuhara, a term which is probably best translated as sanctimoniousness or self-righteousness, a person who holds himself above others. That's a very vague category, right? The issue of, do you do malacha, not do malacha, I like to think of as a yes or no. This is, well, you have to be concerned for what people are going to think. And are they going to think something about you if you refrain from doing malacha when everybody else is going to work? Clear? Better example, perhaps, simpler example, certainly, source number three from the Shulchan Aruch, talking about taking three steps back after Shemona Esrei. So the Shulchan Aruch says, Misha Mosif HaGimel Psios HaViyuhara. If you add to the three steps, that is, in and of itself, Yuhara. That's an act of this self-righteousness. Why? Why is this an act of self-righteousness?
You're kind of like trying not to undergrad another. People might think that you feel that
way. Everybody else has great respect for God, and they take three steps back. I have uber respect for God. I take six steps back. That's what it looks like to people. And so the Shulchan Aruch says, you're not allowed to do it. So in other words, before I act in any context, I am responsible to ask myself, how is this going to be perceived? Does this look self-righteous? It's a vague category, and it's going to depend a lot on where you are, who are you around, and what's your role within the group. But we're called upon to apply this. Another category is the issue of kvod habrios, human dignity. The Gemara in Brachas, Yitzayin, Yites, says that rabbinic prohibitions are overridden in cases involving danger to a person's dignity. That's a vague category, though. What is important to your dignity? What is not important to your dignity? So, for example, I brought you source number 4, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram in his Nishmas Avram talks about a person who needs to have an insulin device on their person. And they live in an area without an Eruv, where it's rabbinically prohibited to carry, to transport outside. Wearing the insulin pump outside would constitute transporting something. But the alternative for them is that they're going to have to stay indoors all of Shabbos. So what are we going to do? Are we going to tell them you have to stay indoors all of Shabbos because you need the insulin pump? So Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram in source number 4 writes, I'm going to go with the English in the interest of time, but you can see the Hebrew there as well. Rabbi Yehoshua Neuwirth, author of the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, told me, it is logical to contend that such a patient could go out with a device on Shabbos even without an Eruv, parentheses, in an area which was not a full-fledged public domain, so there's no biblical issue of transport, it's just rabbinic. If he would wear it in an unusual way, then it would be okay. Why? They permitted rabbinic prohibitions for dignity. In parentheses, Rabbi Dr. Avraham notes that here it's actually doubly rabbinic because it's only rabbinic domain and you're wearing it in an unusual way. And my mentor told me that this is a matter of dignity for such a diabetic. For without this permission, he could never in his entire life leave his house on Shabbos. So it's a matter of dignity, he says. Why is it a matter of dignity for him not to be able to leave his house? What is it? Why is this a dignity issue? I can understand him, you know, going out of his mind, being stuck indoors. But what is the dignity issue? The issue is his ability to function as a member of society. That's the dignity issue. And then he adds that he should leave his house specifically for a mitzvah purpose, like to go to shul, to go to a shir. And then he adds, he noted that people would talk about someone who never attended synagogue or Torah classes. This is also an element of dignity. People are going to say, this person never comes to minyan. This person never goes to a shir. So this is a sensitive calculation. Right? What is dignity for one person isn't for another. I brought you in source number 5, Rabbi Leo Bakshi Doron says, you know, you're not entitled to say this is an issue of my dignity for me personally if it's something that wouldn't be an issue of dignity for everybody else. It's a sensitive calculation. I brought you a third category in sources 6 and 7 dealing with an issue which comes up all the time. Well, two issues, actually, that come up all the time in terms of contact between genders, between men and women. Source number 6 is a fascinating question asked by the Chelkas Yaakov, or Mordechai Yaakov Breisch. And again, I brought you the text, but I'm going to say it outside of the text. We're familiar with the idea that when a woman is a Nida, she and her husband are restricted. They're not allowed to engage in physical contact with each other. The case that he's dealing with is a case of an elderly couple. She has long since stopped having a period. She's not been in Nida for 20 years or whatever it was that was in the... Yeah, more than 20 years. However, she's taking a medication which causes her to bleed. She is not able to go through the process of ending a Nida period. She's not going to mikvah. So she is now in Nida, and she is infirm. She needs help just to stand up and to sit down. She walks around with some kind of a walker. Can her husband help her? that's the question that he's addressing? Or do we have to be concerned that this is considered if affectionate contact between the couple? I'll tell you, I only brought the question here, I didn't bring the answer. The answer is he's able to help her in this case of need. But that's a difficult question, which centers, at least in part, on the question of how I define affection. Or, in number 7, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld deals with a very interesting question. The question, and again, I'm not going to do the text inside in the interests of simplicity and time, but effectively what he does is he says that if someone is an erva, if two people are prohibited to each other, then not only are they not supposed to kiss each other, but they're also not supposed to do an air kiss. They're not supposed to blow a kiss to each other or make some kind of a sign of affection like that. He says that's considered also to be inappropriate affection. So what we're seeing in this category are that there are legal issues that are not black and white. They require application to the case at hand, and someone on the scene has to ask, is this self-righteous? Is this not self-righteous? Is this affectionate? Is this not affectionate? Is this a violation of somebody's dignity? Is it not a violation of somebody's dignity? And that's what they tried to do in their paper in source number 8, was to address, not in the ethos part, but in the halachic, more straightforward halachic part, they tried to address the question of women's ordination and say, well, is this considered to be a position of authority? Is it not considered a position of authority for somebody to be the rabbi of the shul? What is the nature of smicha? Yeah, they're trying to do this sort of an application to the question of women's ordination. Who gets to make this application? Who gets to decide this sort of application? For the self-righteousness issue, for the affection issue, who makes this kind of a calculation? Sorry?
Probably usually a combination between the posik and the person, or discussion between them.
I think everybody makes this calculation on a regular basis. It's true that some calculations are harder than others, like the questions that are being posed here, or the stakes may be higher than others, and so therefore you're going to consult with somebody who knows the area and who knows past rulings and who can, you know, make an assessment. But all of us deal with these issues on a day-to-day basis. I mean, really, like on a day-to-day basis. A husband and wife have a 2-year-old, and the 2-year-old needs to have dinner now. Why does 2-year-old need to have dinner now? Because he's 2. He needs to have dinner now. One spouse, let's say the wife, make it as simple as possible. The wife's very busy. She's behind at work and has a paper that has to be done or whatever it is. She says to the husband, "Can you give him dinner?" He says, "Well, minyan is starting any minute at shul. I need to go daven with a minyan." So what's more important? What's he supposed to choose to do? Is he supposed to go to shul, or is he supposed to help his wife and give dinner to the 2-year-old? This is going to require an application of principles like this. It's not, you're not calling the rabbi now and saying, "Rabbi, do we need to come to shul?" "Well, actually, we only have 9, so we need to do that." That's a calculation you make in your home. These things come up. You get invited to somebody's house for a meal on Shabbos. You go over to their house, and you see that they're doing something which you understand is not supposed to be done on Shabbos. Based on your understanding and what you learned, they took cold soup out of the fridge and they put it on the blech. Leave aside all halachic questions. Was it on the blech when Shabbos started? Was it not? This is not a Hilchos Shabbos year. They're doing something which you think that shouldn't be done. Do you eat? Do you embarrass them by not eating? Well, that requires that you make an analysis for yourself. What are the issues that are involved? Is it a rabbinic issue? Is it a biblical issue? There's issues of embarrassing people. Should I say something to them? Am I supposed to tell them, this is something you should ask the rabbi about? You all make these assessments on a regular basis, and there isn't always a rabbi available to ask. Now, so you're at university level, so maybe you're not as independent in terms of making the decisions yet, but you will be. So the first category and the first mechanism is actually on a very basic level, in which one needs to have knowledge of the halachic issues, as well as, frankly, clarity regarding human behavior and psychology. right? It's not just about what does the book say, but it's about its application to, you know, real life human beings. And you may go to the rabbi for guidance, but the rabbi is fundamentally an intellectual resource. Not, the rabbi is not performing a ritual role here. The rabbi says, okay, and now it's okay. You follow? Clear? I feel like it's quiet in here. All right, we have to get things moving here. Category two. Beyond the application of halakha to a particular situation, which we saw in category one, we now have to talk about category two, which is more sophisticated. Fleshing out halakhic principles in order to define their practical application. Okay, and this is what actually the OU was referring to. If you flip back to source number one for a second, in their category of halakha, right, the third paragraph in source number one, Mikra, it's the second paragraph, but it's Mikra, where they talked about overarching directives like Shabbatot, the day should be a day of Shabbat, or Kedoshim to you, you shall be holy. And the question is, how do I define that in practice? And here, it is the role of a chacham. It is the role of a sage, and it's a ritual role in which the job of the chacham, the job of the rabbi, is supposed to be to explain how to apply this biblical principle. Rabbi Usher Weiss wrote something in source number 9 that I thought was helpful in outlining this. He says, in the entire Torah, the sages of the spoken Torah, meaning the rabbis, only explain the Torah's intent. But in mitzvos and laws which have been given into their hands, they are like lawgivers, empowered even to be lenient in biblical matters for the needs of the moment or to prevent financial loss, even though in other areas the sages lack the power to uproot biblical law in permitting an action. To explain that outside of the excerpt. Sometimes the job of the rabbi is simply to explain what the Torah says, meaning the Torah says I'm not supposed to wear wool and linen. However, I don't know what that means. Does that mean when the wool and the linen are spun together into a thread? Does it mean a garment that has linen in the lining, and then there's wool as the thread that attaches the button to the garment? What does a garment made of wool and linen mean? So I go to the rabbi, and I say, Rabbi, what is the Torah telling me? And the rabbi explains it. That's relatively straightforward. What is less straightforward is when it comes to defining terms like Shabbaton or Yashar Vatov, and saying, so what is this? You know, what exactly does the Torah expect of me? If you flip to source number 10, you get I'm going to go to 11. I like 10 because it's based in the Talmud, but 11 is the clearer source. So I'm going to skip to 11. 10 is interesting. Ask me about it later and I can tell you about it. But 11. The Medrash on the concept of Shavuot, of halting your malacha on Shabbos. So 11, the Medrash says, the Torah says, Ushmartem es hayom hazeh ledoroseichem. You shall guard this day for all generations. So the Medrash asks, Lama namar, why did the Torah need to say, you shall guard this day for all your generations? It already said, Kol malacha lo yaseh bahem, all malacha shall not be performed on them. The Torah says, don't do malacha. Why do you need another pasuk telling me to guard this day? So the answer is, from there, from the other verse, I would only have known that a person may not perform those acts which are prohibited as malacha. However, there's another category. Actions that are prohibited as shavut. I heard some people during the preparation time on this. What does the word shavut mean? A halting. Right? Lishbot is to halt, but it's a technical term. It refers to rabbinic prohibitions, where the rabbi said, don't do this on Shabbat, even though biblically it doesn't appear to be prohibited. So what this medrash is saying is that one verse tells me not to engage in malacha, biblically prohibited work. And then there's another verse that says, don't engage in rabbinically prohibited work. That's what you get from the verse, and you shall guard this day, which includes those acts prohibited as Shavuot. So I have one verse telling me don't do biblical malacha, and one verse telling me don't do rabbinic malacha. What's the problem with what I just said? One verse says don't do that which the Torah says is malacha. One verse says don't do that which the rabbis say is malacha. Is it rabbinic or biblical? If it's what the rabbis say is malacha, why is there a verse for it? It's not biblical at all. So the Vilna Gaon explains in source number 12 that this is a source saying, no, the rabbis are actually responsible to define certain categories of what you're not supposed to do on Shabbat. This may include, from this or other sources, muktzah. The Gemara has a nice long discussion about what is included in muktzah and what is not, and it says that it evolved over time. There was one period when almost everything was prohibited under muktzah. Like, you think muktzah is difficult now. But standard things, like basically the only thing you'd be allowed to pick up on Shabbos would be like a fork to eat your meal. That's basic. There are three utensils that you're allowed to pick up, and that's it. And then it changed over time. The Rambam tries to explain how it is that the laws of muktzah can change over time. What do you mean? Who entitled them to include things or to exclude things? And the answer, and the Aruch HaShulchan goes into this at length, is that the law of muktzah was meant to be a protection for Shabbos. Because technically, if all you do is refrain from the 39 categories of malacha, you could do all sorts of stuff on Shabbos. You could engage in business on Shabbos. Why am I not allowed to buy things on Shabbos? It's very funny. When you speak to people who have no substantive background in learning halacha, and you ask them, what is it that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos? Right? You get two answers, generally speaking. Right? One is use electricity, and the other is do business. So electricity is its own discussion, where that's from. But doing business is a derabanan. Rabbinically prohibited. Why? Because when you engage in a transaction, you write something down. And writing is biblically prohibited. So it's a rabbinic prohibition. Don't buy things because you're going to want a receipt. Or don't sell things you'd want to receive, whatever it is. But it's a rabbinic prohibition. Biblically, you could engage in commerce on Shabbos. Biblically, you could rearrange your house. You could decide you want to move all your furniture around. You could bring the furniture over to somebody else's house. Right? The biblical prohibition against transport on Shabbos is only in certain very restricted areas. Yeah, there are all sorts of things that you could do, and you would totally lose the atmosphere of Shabbos. And the rabbis are instructed, create rabbinic prohibitions, and it's from this source that we're being told to do so. Another example, a simpler example, yeah?
Do we consider these as rabbinic like additions or as definitions of what the Torah is telling us?
That's a really good question, and the answer is it's a hybrid. It's quasi-rabbinic, quasi-biblical. And the best illustration is actually coming in number 13, and then we ask the question. That I brought you just a brief piece of a longer paragraph, but it's enough, I think, to give you a sense of it. The Rambam writes, there's a rabbinic mitzvah to examine the sick, right? Bikur cholim. Bikur cholim does not mean visiting the sick. Please, strike that from your minds. Bikur cholim means examining the sick. You're supposed to look after them, see what they need, take care of them, and so on. Also, there's a rabbinic mitzvah to be involved in all burial needs. And the Rambam says, even though all of these are rabbinic mitzvot, they're included in love your neighbor as yourself. V'havdil recha kamocha. I don't understand what the Rambam just did. Is visiting the sick or going to a funeral, is that rabbinic or biblical? You follow? It's biblical. Love your neighbor as yourself, and this is a manifestation of that. But it's rabbinic, because there's no pasuk in the Torah that says go to a funeral. Right? We're told about burying people because Hashem buries Moshe. Right? So that shows the importance of it. But at the end of the day, it's actually in this weird in-between category. And that's what category two is. Mitzvot which appear in the Torah, and the rabbis are instructed to apply them and to give us the specific implementation of that which is left vague within the Torah. There are some great examples of this that I did not bring here because we would be here forever just on this topic. All sorts of applications for this exist. I brought you this piece in the Minchas Asher in Rav Asher Weiss in source number 14, in which he talks about this. I'm just trying to figure out whether I really want to go here. Or whether it's going to take too much time in it, but it's a good discussion. I'm going to skip it. But this is your second category, is where the rabbis are meant to apply what the Torah said, and jump to number 15, please. Number 15 is potentially the basis for what empowers the rabbis to do this. Rabbeinu Nissim, writing in the 14th century, says the following. He says, you should not have difficulty. He's in the middle of a conversation, but I'll explain the context. But he says, don't have difficulty with the Torah statement of Heichan Sivanu Milo Tasser. I guess I do need to explain it before we see it. Okay. He's trying to define the boundaries between biblical and rabbinic, and he has a problem. You light menorah for Hanukkah? Okay, some here light the menorah for Hanukkah, some do not. Those who do not light menorah were present when somebody else lit menorah? Okay, what's the first bracha on menorah lighting? Right? Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam asher kiddushanu b'mitzvah osav, right? Vitzivanu lahadlik ner shel Hanukkah, right? So the Gemara asks a question. What did that bracha just say? That God commanded us to light Hanukkah candles, right? Hanukkah lights. What exactly is the verse in which the Torah says to light Hanukkah candles? That would be quite a trick, given that the events of Hanukkah take place somewhere around the year 165 before the Common Era, right? The Chumash is long gone by then. Where did God command us to light Hanukkah candles? Says the Gemara. Well, the Gemara gives two psukim. One pasuk is Lo Tasur. Do not stray from whatever the sages tell you. The other one is Shalavicha v'yageidcha zekenecha v'yomrulach. You should ask your elders, and they will tell you what it, you know, what happened, and they'll tell you what you are supposed to do. So Rabbeinu Nissim has a problem. He says, well, if that's really true, then all rabbinic law is now biblical. Right? If you're going to tell me that lighting Hanukkah candles is covered under this biblical mitzvah of Lo Tasur, you shall not stray, then every rabbinic law is covered under you shall not stray, and it's not rabbinic anymore. You follow? So take a look at source number 15, where Rabbeinu Nissim says, don't worry about that. This statement from the Gemara of the where did we get this command, you shall not stray. He says it sounds like it's biblical, but he says that's only an asmachta. It's a rabbinic idea which we link to a biblical verse. Just as the text assigned to the sages the role of accepting and explaining the Torah, so we should listen to them when they enact buffers for the Torah. He says that what the Torah is telling us is, yes, you're supposed to listen to the Chachamim when they explain the Torah, and that's the literal application of Lo Tasur. When the rabbis are explaining something that's straightforward, like explaining what is a woolen linen garment, that's where they have this level of authority of Lo Tasur. However, in addition, we're also supposed to listen to them when they create these buffers for the Torah as well. The Chachamim are considered the emissaries of the Torah. So that's your second category. Your first category is just, here are principles that we know to be true. I have to apply it to a particular situation. Will it embarrass somebody? Will it not embarrass somebody? Whatever, you know, the case may be. The second category is fleshing out halachic principles. And here, it's something that is assigned specifically to those who are trained in the sources, those who are trained in halacha. Now, what Rabbi Weiss doesn't do, Rabbi Asher Weiss in his discussion, and what really, unfortunately, nobody does, it seems, in this discussion, I've looked at quite a few sources on it, is to say, so who qualifies? Is it anybody with ordination? Is it smicha that does it? Do you have to publish a certain amount? Like, do you have to be accepted, voted in by, you know, the Great Beis Din? Like, you know, how do you get to do it? And that's one of these gray areas. We don't have a clearly delineated standard, which is a problem. But that's category two. And then we get to category three, which is the most fun. Category three, although you can argue that category two is, but I'm going to say category three because that's what we haven't done yet, and I like to build the anticipation. So category three is, as I put it on the sheet, halachic innovation. The point where somebody is going to create a new decree or a new enactment to deal with new circumstances on the basis of halachic principles. Example. Take a look at source number 16, please. the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, is talking about how the sages of his time, and I gave you the age, 13th to 14th century, are able to create punishments for people who don't listen to the rules that they've enacted. Now, the rule is, ordinarily, that there are certain penalties prescribed in the Torah for violation of biblical law. However, we don't find such penalties, other than one, for violation of rabbinic law. But he says, our courts do it. Our courts create legislation and punish people who violate it. Communities, for centuries, had various rules about paying the community's taxes, where the government of the broader country would say to the Jewish community, you have to give X amount, and then the leaders of the community would break it down and say, each family gives this. Or the families in this bracket give this, the families in that bracket give that, kind of a progressive tax. But they would do that, and there were penalties if people didn't follow those rules. So take a look at source number 16, where Rabbeinu Asher seeks to justify this practice. He says, true, the Gaonim wrote that even though we do not litigate fines today, we aren't empowered to fine people, still we compel people to accept the word of the sages of that generation, meaning each generation. And the text in Scripture assigned it only to the sages, leaders of the generations, who set and embed nails. That was the best I could do for Kovim v'not im masmerot. And who at times are more lenient than the Talmud's laws, and who at times are more strict to create a buffer and fence as needed for that time. The sages are empowered, he says, to create laws and to create punishments, to be lenient and to be strict. This is new. Right? We talked about applying known principles, and we talked about fleshing out categories that the Torah gives, but this is brand new, that the sages are able to create laws and that they're able to implement penalties. That's something new and different. And it exists in a whole bunch of different sources. Number 17 talks about the sages changing the rules for accepting witnesses in court. Normally, there's a rule that says that you can't hear testimony unless both litigants are present. Otherwise, the judges are not allowed to hear testimony. However, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein, also known as the Trumas HaDeshen, in a particular case said, you know what, we're allowed to hear it without the other litigant because the other litigant was somebody who would intimidate the witnesses and they wouldn't speak. So therefore, we're going to hear the testimony without the knowledge of the other litigant. And he said, yeah, we're licensed to do that. That's okay. We can. We're empowered to do that. This is something which comes up directly in terms of our discussion about ordination for women. For those who have been wondering, are we ever going to get back to that? To that original topic. It comes up. It comes up both on the permissive side and on the prohibiting side. Meaning, you're likely familiar with the history of. Institutions teaching Torah Shabbal Peh for women, right? Teaching Gemara for Mishnah and Gemara for women. The fact of the matter is that you see a major change in policy in the beginning of the 20th century, right? The Beis Yaakov movement, the Chafetz Chaim. I hope you're familiar with some of the history involved. That was new and novel. Right? There were women who learned over time, but the idea of creating an institution, a school, in which it's going to be presented as curriculum, was entirely new at that moment in Torah observant history. So, what was the justification for doing it? We are dealing with a new situation, and in this situation, this is what is required. We have a new situation in terms of the influences of the broader world. We have a new situation in terms of women getting advanced education in a secular area and not having a sophisticated Jewish education to match. We whatever the reasons were given, and different speakers on the topic gave different reasons, but fundamentally they felt we are in a new situation, and therefore even though you have all the precedent in the world to say we don't do this, and even though you have Talmudic sources to support not doing it, they said, nonetheless, this is what we need to do. So that's on one side. On the other side, you have this paper from the OU that says that women do not get the title of rabbi. They do not get the title of clergy. You know, I assume that it includes maharat, rabbah, and various other titles, although honestly, from reading the paper, I'm not really sure where the lines are drawn. But they're saying you can't. Now, newsflash, the concept of synagogue clergy is not you know, a concept from the Gemara, right? In the days of the Gemara, the rabbinate was effectively judicial, meaning that you had a regional bench, if you think of courts, right? And there are certain judges who sit on the bench. You don't ordain somebody until there's a vacancy on the bench. And at that point, you ordain somebody and they sit and they now judge cases. There wasn't a rabbi of the shul. That's new. You know, how new is it? Good question. Good study for historians and sociologists. But you can't tell me, there's no way you can tell me that the Gemara says anywhere that a woman can't have the title of rabbi, because there was no title of rabbi. What they're trying to do is apply the sense of Torah, and we saw that back in the first source, based on micro, what they learned from particular texts, based on macro, what they learned from overarching principles, based on precedent. They're trying to say, we have derived that this is what we should say here. Here's a new situation, and we believe that it should be prohibited. That's the process that they're using, just like the Trumas Hadeshin is able to say, in this case, I'm going to alter the way we accept witnesses. Or just like the Rush is saying, in this case, we are going to add laws and penalties. Wow. This is a big problem. The power to do this is a very big problem. There's a law in the Torah. You may have heard of it. It's called Bal Tosif. Does it ring a bell? What does Bal Tosif mean? Yeah, you're not allowed to add on to what's written in the Torah. Lo zoseifa lav. And also, by the way, bal tigra, you're not allowed to subtract. No adding to the Torah. No subtracting from the Torah. If the Kohen goes up to do Birchas Kohanim, and Yivarecha, Yair Yisa, and then says, you know, if you guys could just wait a minute, I want to give a fourth bracha, right? We kick him out. You're not allowed to do that. You can't add to the add to the Torah. Somebody comes to shul and says, I have a neat talis. Here, it has strings on two corners. Right? It's a line. I don't know how you do that. But whatever, you know what I'm saying. Don't worry about the specifics of the talis. You can't subtract and you can't add. So by what right do they get to create enactments like this? And it would seem, you know, straightforward that this is a problem. Even if you'll tell me lo tasur, do not stray from their words, gives them authority, but we already define that very narrowly as authority to explain biblical text, not to create something wholesale. So the Rambam wrestled with this problem in source number 18. The laws of Mamrim, which are the laws about the authority of the Sanhedrin. And the Rambam writes, since a court may decree and prohibit that which is permitted, and its prohibition will stand for generations, and they also may permit Torah prohibitions temporarily, right? They can actually have Harat Shah, a temporary dispensation, to permit things. What is the Torah's prohibition? You shall not add to it, and you shall not subtract from it. If you're telling me that the rabbis can create things and prohibit or even permit, what do I do with the prohibition against adding or subtracting? So he gives you an example. And his example is the decree against chicken and milk. Right? Chicken parmesan. Why is it that I'm not allowed to have chicken parmesan? Why am I not allowed to have it?
Rabbinic
prohibition. What's the rationale?
People will think that it's meat.
People will think chicken is meat? Tell me something. Are you a vegetarian? Never in my life will I confuse chicken and meat. You're not going to confuse chicken and meat. Even if you grind them up, you're not going to confuse chicken and meat. Take a look at source number 18, where the Rambam explains the logic as an example of what the rabbis are empowered to do. He says, if they, meaning the people, if the people were to say, poultry is biblically permitted, which it is, and we will prohibit it, and inform the nation, this is if the court says, not the population, and inform the nation that this is a decree, lest people come to sin, saying, poultry is permitted because it is not specified, so too chayot are permitted, for they were not specified. Meaning, we have within the Torah a distinction between different kinds of animals. There are behemot and chayot. What is a behema? Sorry? Well, species that tend to be domesticated. Chayot are? Second grade children? No. Chayot are? wild animals, wild species, generally speaking. There are halachic differences. For example, certain kinds of fats are prohibited from one and not from the other. The laws of Kisui Hadam, covering the blood after Shechita, will vary from one versus the other. So the Torah's prohibition against eating meat and milk says, do not cook, or boil, whatever, seethe, a goat in its mother's milk. A goat is from the behemah category. So I might say, in that case, just like poultry isn't in the biblical law, so too chayot are not in the biblical law. I could have deer meat with milk. Deer parmesan. I don't know. Venison. Whatever. My vegetarian daughters are never going to forgive me. Don't tell them. So he says here, the concern of the court is that people are going to say, chayot are permitted with milk. And then another one might come along and say, well, you know what, behemoth flesh is also permitted because the Torah only said goat milk. Maybe the prohibition against meat and milk biblically is only goats with milk. And then another might come and say, no, goat flesh is also permitted in the milk of a cow or a ewe, since the Torah only says his mother of his species. Sorry, so before it was saying goat meat with milk. And now what we're going to say is maybe it's only meat with goat milk that's prohibited. And then someone else is going to come along and say, not only that, it's the goat in its own mother's milk. But any other milk would be fine. Define it more narrowly. So therefore what they said is, we're going to broaden and make it clear that this prohibition applies to all meat. And the way we're going to do it is by taking that last category of meat, or things you might think of as meat, it comes from a living thing that's upon the earth, take poultry and prohibit that in milk as well. And that way no one will ever be so narrow. That's the rationale that the Rambam is presenting for prohibiting poultry and milk. So without getting further into the discussion, well then why not include fish? Because that's the logical next question. His point isn't that. His point is the wording with which he began the decree. The way that he wants the court to frame it is by telling people, poultry is biblically permitted. We will prohibit it and inform the nation this is a decree lest people come to sin. In other words, you have to tell people it's rabbinic. The prohibition, according to the Rambam, against adding to the Torah is specifically if you fail to tell people this is a rabbinic prohibition. Once you tell people this is rabbinic, you have satisfied the biblical law. That's the Rambam's way of looking at it. Others disagree. The Raivad disagrees. He says, you don't need to do that. You don't need to tell people that at all. In source number 19, he says, that's not a problem. And what he says is very, very important. He says, all of this, meaning everything that the Rambam said, should be carried away by the wind. That's, in other words, he doesn't agree with it. He believes it's nothing. For anything they decree and prohibit as a buffer and protection for Torah is not subject to the law of you shall not add. Even if they establish it for generations and make it like Torah and link it to Scripture, and he says, after all, we find in various places in the Gemara, they'll say about a law, it's derabanan, but the text is an asmachta. It's linked to the text. He says, we're good with that. It's okay. Why? What's reading paragraph 19. Why is it that the rabbis are able to add to the Torah and it's not a problem of you shall not add?
Just a buffer.
It is just a buffer, that's true. But what's the rationale? He doesn't tell you. He doesn't give you a clear rationale. What he says is, anything that they say, anything that the sages say, is not subject to this prohibition. It's automatically a part of Torah.
Emunas Chachamim.
Well, it's not even Emunas Chachamim, although that's required in order to accept this. But what he's saying is, if the sages say it, it's not Bal Tosif. The warning of do not add is not speaking to them. It's speaking to random person. The sages, and again, we haven't defined who sages are actually told they're supposed to add to the Torah. And we're going to come back to that in just a minute. There still are limits on what they can do. I didn't go into it here because I felt this was long enough. But they can't prohibit something that the Torah explicitly permits. If the Torah explicitly says something is allowed, they're not allowed to prohibit it even when they feel there's good reason to. certain types of decrees may not be made after the close of the Talmud. There are certain checks on what they can do. But there's an awful lot of power first. So what's the mechanism? Where does this come from in the Torah? Two different approaches. The Rambam's approach is in source number 20. The Rambam says that the sages are commissioned to be guardians of Torah. That's their job. The God wants them to guard the Torah. Take a look. The Rambam here is in his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah. He does this sort of breakdown of the different categories of laws. And we're going to focus on the fourth and fifth. He says, the fourth segment of laws are laws established by the prophets and sages of each generation as a fence and buffer for the Torah. That's your fourth category. When they want to protect the Torah from violation, where does it come from? These fulfill God's general command. God told them to make such laws. Vishamru es mishmarti, the Torah says. Ushmartem es mishmarti, as the Rambam has it here. They shall guard my preserve. Hashem says, I want the sages to guard my laws. Regarding which we have a tradition that what it means is, and this is the Gemara statement, asu mishmeret l'mishmarti, make a preserve for my preserve. In other words, make laws that will protect that which I want protected. These are what the sages term gzerot. And when, and this is going to be a key point, read this next line, when everyone agrees to one of these gzerot, one may never violate it. And as long as the prohibition spreads in Israel, there is no way to cancel the gzerah, and even prophets cannot permit it. I'm going to come back to that phrase in a little bit. But that's a gezerah. It's the Torah says, I want you to guard my laws, and that's the way that they get guarded. So, for example, the Torah says, don't do malacha. One of the malachot is writing, rabbinic decree, I don't want you to engage in commerce because you're going to write. Or, another example, I'm not allowed to tilt a lamp, an oil lamp, to make the fuel burn better. So there's a rabbinic decree against reading next to an oil lamp, because if you see it's not burning well, your instinct is, let me shift and get better light, and that's a problem. That's a gzeirah. In his next paragraph, he talks about takanot, which are where the sages actually actively create enactments, and it's similar to the gzeirah for our purposes, so I'm not going to read it out, but you can see it there. The Rambam's view is that that the sages are commissioned to act as guardians of the Torah. And you can see in source number 21 and source number 22 more along those lines, with the Rambam tracing them back to you shall not stray from that which they tell you, right or left. You have Ramban there as well. That's one approach. The second approach, though, goes back to what we saw in the Ravid in source number 19. The Rambam's view is that the sages are commissioned to be guardians of Torah. The Ravid's view is that you're misunderstanding it. What they say is Torah. This is what Torah is. Torah is not simply five books of Moses and another 19 books that make it in Tanakh. Torah is what the duly licensed court states as well. We saw that in the Ravid's assumption in number 19. We see it also in the Rashba in source number 23. He says, he's talking about are the sages who discuss Baal Tosif not adding to the Torah. They did not say that there is an issue of adding other than where he adds on his own initiative. Like a Kohen who adds a blessing on his own. The law doesn't prohibit adding to the Torah unless somebody just says, I want to add. But when the sages stand and enact for a need, there is no issue of adding, for the Torah has already said, Al piyatara sher yarucha, that you're supposed to act by the Torah that they shall teach you. So therefore, whatever they teach you is itself part of Torah. Are we clear? I'm not asking whether people like it, but I'm asking if we're clear on the concept. This third category, this most broad and sweeping category, empowers the sages to create enactments and rules meant to protect what they believe is the law of the Torah, based on Ushmartem es Mishmarti, based on Shalavicha V'Yagecha, and they're not subject to the issue of Baal Tosif, of adding to the Torah, either because they are commissioned to do this as guardians of the Torah, or because what they say is Torah. Where does this power come from? So one way to look at it is that their power is from these verses, the verses that we've read, like Lo Tasur, not to stray from, like the issue of not the issue of Vishamu es Mishmarti. That's one way that you can look at it. However, there's a second way to look at it that I think is very important to understand. And it really goes to the heart of where this issue of the women's ordination is today as well. I brought you the Ran in source number 24, Rabbeinu Nisim, in which he articulates three different categories of rabbinic rule, or rabbinic decree. We're on the last side now. We're in the home stretch. One, where the prohibition has spread through most of Israel, the rabbis decree something, and it has spread through most of Israel, no court may cancel the words of another court, even where it is greater in wisdom and number. That's it. Once a decree is accepted by the Jewish people, you can't change it. And he says that applies to the special 18 gezerot, 18 decrees that are mentioned in the Gemara, which nobody is able to remove. Eliyahu HaNavi can show up and say, Mashiach is here and we're changing this rule, and the answer is, no, you're not. We'll take the Mashiach, but everything else you're not authorized to do. That's category one. Category two, where the prohibition has not spread through most of Israel, but it's a decree which most of the community could bear. It's something that the community can handle. It's just not, it hasn't been accepted. So this is where we say a court cannot cancel the words of another court unless it is greater in wisdom and number. If they're greater in wisdom and number, and here's a very important question, what does number mean? How is one court greater than another court in number? I understand wisdom. How could one court be greater than another in number? Courts have a defined number of people.
More people go to that court, or they have a
bingo.
Community?
The Rambam says number of followers. That's it. Number of followers in the age of Facebook. That's what determines which court is more authoritative. So a court that comes along that can demonstrate greater wisdom and that is followed by more people is able to reverse that decree, even if it was a decree that in and of itself should have been legitimate. And then the third category is a decree which has not spread because the community can't bear it, it's too strict, then even a lesser court is able to permit it. Tell me something. Think about these three categories. Where it has spread by to all Israel, no court can do anything about it. Where, in theory, it could have spread, but it hasn't, a court that has more followers is able to reverse it. Where a decree is too much for people, any court can reverse it. What is the source for the authority of the rabbis who are issuing these decrees? Yes, the nation. Their authority comes from the Jewish people themselves. That's what the Ran is articulating here. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserlis, in source number 25, basing himself on the Trumas Hadesh and Rabbi Isserlis, we quoted Rabbi Isserlis at a different point earlier, talks about halacha books. Right? He's in the 16th century. He had not seen Art Scroll, I think. But he describes the acceptance of works of halacha, and he says, one should not be lenient in a matter in which the compositions, these books, that have spread throughout most of Israel have been strict. Don't be lenient if the books have been strict, unless one has received from his masters that we don't follow this particular stringency. Why does a book have authority? You're the Rama. Why does a book have authority? Because it has spread throughout most of Israel. The community is what gives it authority. I brought you a Rashba in source number 26 along the same lines regarding this Tuvei Ha'ir, the city council, and their power to make rules. There are all sorts of references to this down through the halachic literature. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau discusses this as well, not in the piece that I have in number 27, but in the same article that I cite in number 27. It's fundamentally the community that gives the authority, which is why we have a rule that says that the court cannot create a decree which the tzibur, which the community, can't bear. If it's an unbearable decree, and that's going to be defined by what the community does in response, if it's an unbearable decree, then it's not valid. And we have a case in the Gemara of a decree that was deemed to be unbearable. You familiar at all? The oil decree. You're familiar, I hope, with the rules of Bishul Akum and Pas Akum. right? We have rules that are meant to prevent over-socialization. There's a concern that if Jews are going to hang out with their non-Jewish neighbors, they're going to discover that their neighbors are nice people too. Their neighbors are fine, upstanding, moral human beings, and they are. And the result of that will be that for people whose respect for the law and for Torah is not that strong, they'll say, well, then what's the big deal if I just marry one of my neighbors? So they try to minimize that type of interaction where you will learn behavior from them and potentially even come to mix with them too much. And so they said, you're not supposed to have bread that they baked, except when you can. You're not supposed to eat certain foods that they cook. That's the law of Bishul Akum. Well, at one point there was also a law called Shemen Akum, that you couldn't have olive oil that they process. That's a very big deal. We use olive oil in cooking a lot. It's very healthy. So that decree was deemed to be too much, and it was actually repealed because it was too much. And writes Rabbi Lau in source number 27, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, he says, the entire force of takanot and gezerot, enactments and decrees in their various circumstances, which were enacted in the time of the Talmud and Halachic authorities, is predicated upon national agreement. We have to agree. Therefore, quotes, quoting the Gemara, we do not enact a gezerah upon the community unless the majority of the community can bear it. The authority comes from the community, and therefore the court has to be responsive to the needs of the community. Further, source number 28, the Ma'ari Bruna, Rabbi Yisrael Bruna, writes, whenever we find that the court has the strength for the sake of fencing in a matter, they have the ability to issue a decree for the sake of preventing some kind of a violation of the biblical law. This is for something which is obvious to everyone to be a good enactment and a fence for the world. Therefore, all are obligated in it by agreement of the leaders of the generation. But when they say that there is a public obstacle in the matter for communities and settlements, then no one can force them to enter doubt and harm. This is easy to grasp. He says, you can only make a decree if it's clear to everybody that it's helpful. If it's actually going to cause more people to sin and to stumble, then it's not valid, writes the Ma'ari Bruna, as quoted in the Tshuva of the Maharam Mintz. There are limits, because your power is derived from the community, there are limits that are dictated by the acceptance of the community. Now, let's not kid ourselves. Decrees are still fundamentally paternalistic, in the sense that there's a court saying to the community, we think this is in your best interests. That's the starting point. And the best proof of it is source number 29, Ula's comment in the Gemara. Ula said, when they make a decree in the West, what's the West? What's the West? It's not California. What's the West? Or Vancouver? Israel. He's talking about Israel. When they make a decree in Israel, they do not reveal the reason for 12 months of the year. Trace Erechishasa. Why? Lest people say they disagree and come to mock it. Right? If I tell people we're prohibiting this because X, you know what the way people are. Right? People are very bribable by their own minds. They're going to, because they don't want to follow the decree, they'll come up with arguments for why the reason is invalid and they won't follow it. So we have a simple answer. Don't tell people why you made the decree. Just tell them this is prohibited. So you can't get away, and there are certain rules for when you can actually get away with this and when you cannot get away with this. Tosus points out that that there are certain times when they are obligated to give the reason. But the point is that even though we keep talking about the power of the court being derived from the nation, there are boundaries to that. There are limitations on their limitations. What is clear, and then I'm going to summarize everything since, you know, it's been an hour, almost a quarter. But the last point is that this is clearly a ritual rule. This is not something that just anybody gets to do. Once again, I'm stuck in terms of the question of, so who is it who is able to do it? If you're going to argue lo tasur, you could make the argument that it's actually the high court in Yerushalayim, which we haven't had in a very long time. However, from the fact that there have been gezerot and takanot over the centuries, clearly it isn't just about that, and there's a lot of discussion then about who gets to do it. But what is clear is that it requires somebody who has a communal facet to them, because you need the community's compliance with it. It has to be somebody who's responsible to the community, and it also is going to require somebody with that level of knowledge of Torah. Go back to the source sheet for the last source. The Chazonish writes, he's dealing with a completely separate question. The Shemitah and Yovel in the second Beis HaMikdash. So Shemitah exists in the time of the second temple. Yovel does not. Yovel is not observed. And the reason given for why Yovel is not observed is because, depending on how you count Shemitah and Yovel, you will end up potentially with 2 years in a row in which people can't plant. They're not going to survive. That's the explanation for why the sages don't create the law of Yovel. There's a problem with that idea, though. If you're going to tell me that the people won't survive, what do you do with the biblical verse? The Torah promises that when you observe Shemitah and Yovel and you say, well, how am I going to eat? God is going to take care of it. He's going to send you blessing. So what do you mean you can't survive? You'll survive just fine. Observe Shemitah and Yovel and God will bless you and everything will be good. To which he gives the following answer in the last source. He says, logically, there was blessing, I added in, for Shemitah observers in the second temple too. And after the destruction as well. For the court above does what the court below decrees. God's court does whatever is decreed below. So if the sages say there's Shemitah, then they're going to extend blessing for those who observe Shemitah. But he argues the blessing is stated once they make the effort, meaning to manage through Shemitah, or when they are exempt from further effort, if they reach a point where they've done everything they can. How much effort to make is assigned to the sages by analysis of Torah with their divine inspiration. How far you have to go is up to the sages. And they felt that decreeing Yovel in the second Beis HaMikdash would impose too great a duty on the people, and therefore they didn't decree Yovel. I bring this here because he speaks of it being given to the sages to make that determination. There has to be some high body that is responsible to the community and that is erudite enough to be able to do this. So, to go back through what we've said in brief, we presented the problem. The problem is the gray area. Why can't we just have a halacha that's just black and white, usur, mutter, and done? And I hope if I've got nothing else, across in the last hour and 11 minutes, it's that it doesn't work that way. The fundamental reason it doesn't work that way is because life is very context-driven. There are new circumstances that come up, and there are situations in which the application of law is necessarily going to be unclear. The first and most basic category is one that we apply in our daily lives. We may consult rabbis because we don't know enough or aren't necessarily sensitive enough and say, you know what, I need guidance on this. The stakes are high. What am I supposed to do? Can I eat the soup that they took out of the fridge and put on the blech? Is it okay for me to daven in this way, or is it, self-righteous? All manner of practices that we talked about in our first category. So that's something that everybody is called upon to exercise but may consult a rabbi on. The second category is where the Torah gives us broad principles but expects the Chachamim to actually apply them, like the laws of Muktzah that we talked about, Malachan Chol HaMoed in the source that I skipped, the definition of Shabbatel, the definition of Ve'ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha. It's left to the sages to actually create applications which sort of are bridging biblical and rabbinic. And then the third is when new circumstances come up and there's a need to create decrees to protect the Torah or enactments, active enactments, and that's not considered to be adding to the Torah according to the Rambam because you have to tell people, hey, this is just rabbinic, or according to the Ravid, it's not considered adding to the Torah because this is what the Torah wants them to do. They're charged with doing it. Their power to do this is either because they are told by the Torah to do this and therefore they are guardians of Torah, and that's one view. But the other take is that the community actually empowers them. They are the shlichim. They are the emissaries of the community, and therefore they are responsible to the community in the way that they make the decree, and what they say is binding if it is accepted by the community. What we've done is tip of the iceberg. I hope that that's clear. That what we're doing here is tip of the iceberg. I hope it's correct. Like I said, these are first thoughts on it. I've never spoken on the topic as broadly as this. I've spoken on sort of pieces within it. But I think that this reflects some of what is behind the struggle that rabbis are having and in this case the OU panel, is having in trying to figure out what to do on the issue of women's ordination. They are responsible to the community, and they have to figure out something that meets the needs of the community, which are so multifaceted, because we need women's advanced education and advanced spiritual roles in the community. I think that's very clear, and I think it was clear in the paper that they understood that. On the other hand, they're trying very hard to avoid a situation in which all lines are blurred and the roles that women have historically played become devalued in the name of this of ordination. And the various other elements, which they already said in their paper, and frankly, they took 16 pages or so to say it, so you can read it there. But that's what they're struggling with, is how to apply this. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting.